Hello and welcome to Tisky Sour. Tonight we're talking about Canada's Liberal darling, Justin Trudeau, and whether the shine has come off his premiership ahead of next Monday's general election. We'll also talk about the Democratic primaries in the US and whether leftists should mind that Elizabeth Warren is currently pulling ahead of Bernie Sanders in the polls. But before all that, we are legally obliged to cover the latest developments in Brexit negotiations, and in particular today's news that a concession on the part of Boris Johnson means a Brexit deal could be in sight. We obviously love an excuse to talk about Brexit on this show, as everyone does in British politics. Hopefully it'll all be over soon, but not so soon that Boris Johnson can call it a triumph. I am joined for this conversation by Luke Savage, who is over from North America. Luke is a staff writer at Jacobin based in Toronto. How's it going?
Great. Thank
How are you finding it here? How's the welcome been?
It's lovely, yeah. Although I'm like I was telling you before, I'm having trouble ordering coffee because apparently normal coffee, or as I see it, is not a thing over here, or it's just becoming a thing.
You sound like Owen. Do you know that story of Owen Smith?
Which one?
Owen Smith stood against Jeremy Corbyn in the leadership, and he was like, oh, everyone talks about cappuccino. I just order a frothy coffee.
Is that the correct nomenclature? Is that what I should ask for at Starbucks?
You could do, well, if you're in his part of North Wales, I suppose, or South, wherever he is, whatever part of Wales, you probably know this. I'm also with Ellie Mae O'Hagan, Wales expert and regular contributor to The Guardian. You're from Wales.
I am from Wales and I speak Welsh. And I can also say that...
You can speak Welsh?
Are you from North?
What part of Wales are you from?
I'm from North West Wales, which is not where Owen Smith is from. I think he's from, like... Yeah, that's...
Where is Pontefract?
I don't know. It's not North Wales. I will say Wales is like separated by a mountain range. So if you're not, like, you kind of know your bit and then, like, you don't really have much of a relationship.
Yeah, what else is over the mountains is irrelevant? Owen Smith territory.
Well, you actually, you have to go out.
What do you call a coffee in Wales?
We call them cappuccinos.
Okay.
Like, it's obviously...
On your side of the mountains.
They sell cappuccino in McDonald's. Like, everybody knows what a cappuccino is. Anyway, I think we can leave Owen Smith behind us.
We're going to start with the apparent Brexit breakthrough, or more accurately described, probably a Brexit climb down by Boris Johnson. So it is understood that negotiations between the EU and the UK, the British side have conceded there will be a customs border in the Irish Sea. So this fundamentally looks a lot like a reversion from Boris Johnson to what was the original offer from the European Union to Theresa May's government, which was that there would be a Northern Ireland only backstop. So Northern Ireland would have to stay in the customs area so as to avoid any hard border infrastructure on the island of Ireland. And then Britain could, or the rest of the UK could, no, it is Britain, isn't it? Because that's what the geographical construct is called. The rest of the UK can float away in whatever customs or single market, well, customs or regulatory arrangement it wants. That was blocked by the DUP, after which Theresa May came up with a post facto excuse for why it was always a terrible idea. She wanted this Northern Ireland backstop. They vetoed it. She said no Prime Minister ever could accept a border down the Irish Sea. But Boris Johnson seems to be going back to that position. In a way, if he can pass it, it makes sense. I mean, many people, or many of the Brexiteers, I think, are obsessed about moving away from the regulatory orbit of the EU and potentially moving closer to the regulatory orbit of the United States. And I think from their behaviour over the past couple of years, they don't seem to give that much of a shit about the union. We know, in fact, that Tory party members care much more about getting Brexit done than they do about keeping Northern Ireland as part of the UK. So this could be, if he manages to pass it through Parliament, the golden ticket for Boris Johnson. Do you think he has... potentially scored a blinder here, Ellie? Can you score a blinder? Did I mix my metaphors?
Played a blinder.
Did he play a blinder? Yeah, good. Did he? Did he do that?
I wouldn't go so far as blinder, but you've told me, but when we were, before we came on air, I was told I wasn't allowed to be pessimistic, so...
No, you can be pessimistic. Okay. Go on, go for it.
Basically, I think... I feel pessimistic about an election in terms of, from the left's perspective, if Boris Johnson goes into it on a wave of Brexit triumphalism. Because I think we need to think about, like, what the impact psychologically on the country will be if he passes a Brexit deal. This is something that we voted on 3 years ago, and we've been in this state of limbo, paralysis, for the last 3 years. It seemed like an intractable problem. And if Boris Johnson manages to ostensibly solve that problem with what I think is a bit of a piece of shit deal. At the time, that won't matter because I think it will, first of all, it will really take the wind out of the sails of the Remain movement. It will be a huge blow to them. I think a lot of Labour's base will feel like pretty devastated. And I think the sort of Leave side will feel like will be given a big boost by it. So to go into an election with like the Leave side and with the Tories feeling like triumphalist and the left and the Remainers feeling deflated is not a good psychological standpoint from which to begin. And I do think that really matters. So I think that doesn't mean that all is lost, but I think that those of us on the left and people in the Labour Party at all levels should be thinking about what do we do about that? What is our answer to that? How do we burst their bubble and how do we sort of create a response to this kind of triumphalism?
That was, in fact, obviously, I make every guest pre-agree their opinions before they come on the show in case they say something that, you know, could go wrong or was not strategic. So what we agreed,
like North Korea,
there was a compromise, which is Ellie was allowed to be pessimistic so long as she put on an addendum, which is all is not lost.
Yeah.
So you've fulfilled your obligations. Very well done.
It was the Navarra backstop.
We still don't know if Boris Johnson did a blinder or whatever.
We still don't. I mean, we probably won't do for a while.
I think it's played a blinder.
Played a blinder.
You do?
I think it's played a blinder.
Oh, right. Played a blinder. You think it's
get James to
do you think
Google
the phrase... No, the phrase is play a blinder.
Right.
I was wrong. But okay. The phrase is, did he play a blinder? But you're not saying he did play a blinder. You're just saying that would be what he would have done if he had done a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm saying that is the phrase. Yeah. I'm saying I'm not sure that he's played a blinder. I think that might be over-egging the pudding somewhat. But I think...
how many metaphors?
Yeah, I like that one.
So friend of Navarra and friend of me, Owen Jones, sent me the Red Box podcast this afternoon when I was making this case to him. And the Red Box podcast sort of argues for a variety of reasons that it isn't necessarily good for Boris Johnson to have got a deal through because perhaps the issue of social class, one of the reasons they argued was the issue of social class might still play a part. However, yeah, I just can't see how this would be bad for him. He's like achieved what a lot of people were starting to think was the impossible. If he passes this deal, it still needs to go through Parliament. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I think probably odds are it still won't pass Parliament. It didn't pass Parliament under Theresa May. And if it's as similar to her deal or her first suggestion,
but I think
you'll
have a lot of
fewer
Tory rebels this time.
Yeah, potentially.
I think they're getting to the point where they're like, if we don't vote it through now, then we'll like just never have Brexit. So I think they will want to vote it through, and then they're probably banking on the idea that they can like renegotiate it once it's passed.
I'm going to give the enthusiasm, which is ultimately, I think it will be a short-term success for Boris Johnson if he can say he's got Brexit done by the 31st. I think this will be better for him than Theresa May's original deal because the rest of the UK, other than Northern Ireland, can, you know, float freely away from the regulatory orbit of the European Union. For me, that's shit, because all it means is that we can undercut the European Union on workers' rights and on regulations, health and safety regulations, for example, and also that we are in a weaker position when we're negotiating a trade deal with Donald Trump in the United States. I think it's completely shit. But considering we're all focused on this process of getting Brexit done, he will have done that, and I think he'll have, you know, a little poll boost. But ultimately, there'll be a general election, and if potential Labour leavers or leavers in Labour seats have no reason whatsoever now to vote for Boris Johnson's Conservative Party. And if, I think, presumably at that point, people will be thinking a little bit less about Brexit, and they'll see that one party has a transformative manifesto and one party. Once Brexit is done, they just have these weird, as we talked about, or as me and Aaron talked about yesterday on Tisky Sour, these weird policies that they've picked out of a hat because some focus group said they'd be popular. So Labour are going to be standing on a platform which is, we can implement an industrial policy which is going to radically make you basically all richer, and we're going to tax the 1% to do it. The Tories' policy is, if you have buried a dead body and you haven't told the judge where you've buried it, you don't get parole early, which to me, reasonable policy. It's in the Queen's speech, but I don't think it is going to be.
Did she read it out like that?
Yeah, she did.
If you bury a body.
Yeah, exactly. I declare.
I don't think
that's the kind of thing that's going to massively swing it in their favour. But anyway, this is going to get all a bit looking into a crystal ball, isn't it? I'm sure we'll come back to this on a Tisky Sour later in the week about, you know, this precise deal and how it's going to play. But Brexit, on a broader question, it's always nice to have a foreigner? Can I call you a foreigner?
Sure you can.
Well, it's nice to have a foreigner in here to talk about what Brexit looks like from
Johnny
afar.
Johnny Foreigner.
Johnny Foreigner. What do you think about it all?
Well,
how does it look to you?
I mean, yeah, I don't have anything, I think, particularly useful or informed to say on the specific question you asked, but it does seem to me that Labour's strategy for the past few years has been to try to change the channel somewhat from Brexit, because Brexit, it seems to me, that the hard remain and the hard, you know, the hard leave positions are kind of cultural. They're catch-alls in a culture war, in a bigger culture war, you know, you know, Labour, as you were saying, is trying to change the channel with a transformative manifesto. So if the election is fought on, you know, as a Brexit election, that would seem to be very disadvantageous from Labour's point of view, and advantageous from Johnson's point of view. But yeah, in North America, I would say the conversation around Brexit is very skewed on, you know, in kind of liberal circles, and even on a lot of the left. I think people sort of assume the default left position is a really hard remain position. Which, you know, as we were talking about before, Michael, it sounds like the Lexit option is not really a serious one anymore. But I think people are not really aware that it, you know,
it's still not a left-right issue.
Yeah,
even though Lexit is practically dead. Mm-hmm. I think it's a bad analysis of Brexit to say what's going on here is a battle between the left and the right. That's not what's going on.
Yeah,
I mean, the Remain campaign has like been colonized by the center, so that's where the left, I think, not necessarily actively hostile towards it, but isn't really like enthused by Remain, because for a lot of hardcore Remainers, the Remain project has been about turning back the clock to like 2012, when a particular set of people were in charge and where politics to this group of people felt understandable and comfortable. And for people on the left, that was when Britain was going through very extreme and a very extreme austerity program and lots of other terrible things. And so the prospect of turning back the clock to that time is not appealing at all, and I think is one that should be actively resisted. So that is really the schism, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And it's very similar to North America, isn't it, where liberals want to turn back the clock to the Obama years.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton is a lot like the Remain campaign. Donald Trump, that's where I think the analogy breaks down, because Donald Trump, it's very clear what he was. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, a racist creep. Whereas Brexit obviously can have a much more fluid meaning than Donald Trump.
I mean, it was pretty racist, though. I mean, the breaking point poster.
Oh, yeah, but that was a particular element of the campaign, whereas Donald Trump, if your political struggle is between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump is disanalogous to Brexit, whereas Hillary Clinton is Remain through and through.
Although I suppose the leave position during the campaign had a certain kind of, as well as all the right wing nativist stuff, there was a certain kind of small p populism, a sort of generic anti-establishment vote, and I do think Donald Trump had a little bit of that energy as well.
And he did it quite well.
Yeah, but I mean, in America certainly, I mean, I think Brexit is discussed a little less in Canada, but in America certainly, it's seen almost exclusively through the lens of Trump and kind of the wider kind of confused conversation around the term populism, which annoys me quite a lot.
We are going to go properly to the United States because next year there will be a presidential election where a Democrat will be facing Donald Trump and hopefully beating him. That's an uncontroversial thing to say in the Navarra Media Studio. And we are going to talk today especially about two candidates, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. The latest YouGov poll shows that Warren is basically flying ahead in the polls. She's on, well, flying ahead's maybe an overstatement, but the momentum is with her. So this is the latest YouGov poll. Warren is on 28%, Biden is on 25%, and Bernie Sanders is on 14%. Is this a surprise to you? Because, I mean, I remember at the beginning of the year, everyone was commenting on why Warren isn't being taken seriously. She was, I think, in the single digits, and it was all about Bernie versus Biden. What explains, I suppose, Warren's phenomenal rise in the polls?
I mean, I think the simplest answer is that she's proven to be a good campaigner, and I think she's running a good campaign. I think I have a somewhat more partisan answer, which is I think the basic arc of the campaign up until the fall has been that you know, the anti-Bernie forces, broadly defined, have kind of cycled through a number of different formulas they've tried. And, you know, so there was the attempt to make Beto O'Rourke into a national figure. I think we can say at this point the very unsuccessful attempt.
Didn't he come back a bit when he started swearing a bit more?
I mean, he came back.
So he sort of tweeted like, he's a fucking racist. Yeah. And then everyone's like, yeah, better. Maybe he's got character.
Yeah, he tried to pivot to making gun control his thing. And I mean, I think he's come back in terms of his visibility on Twitter, but not in the polls, I think. And then after him, you had Mayor Pete.
Yeah.
Who, you know, was another figure who really, I mean, I think even more than O'Rourke, no one had ever heard of him. And all of a sudden he was all over magazines and things like that. And he did have a brief surge. There was one point where I think he was pretty safely established as kind of the fourth candidate. But that didn't last long either. Kamala Harris hasn't been doing well. And, you know, Biden has loomed over the whole thing. But I think his lead has kind of been slowly diminishing. There's not a lot of dynamism to his campaign, and they're having to sort of keep him out of events and stuff. And actually, in this last quarter, his fundraising numbers were really bad. So it does look like the debate is shaping up to be, or the contest is shaping up to be one between Sanders and Warren. And I think what Warren's been able to do, and again, I'll qualify this by saying it is a somewhat partisan reading because I have pretty strong views about this. I think
that's
what Warren's
allowed.
Okay, good. I think what Warren's been able to do is, you know, she's been able to embrace parts of Sanders' agenda and kind of campaign on them in a way which is more politically palatable to the, and more rhetorically palatable to, you know, the professional managerial class constituency that I think has been, you know, dominant in the Democratic Party since the early 90s, and to all of the kind of the newspapers and the sort of big outlets of liberal opinion. I think her success is in some ways an expression of a contradiction. There's clearly a demand for transformative change, but there's also there are a lot of people who are very hesitant about embracing you know, a version of it that I think many people on the U.S. left would find sufficiently radical. And so Warren has actually emerged as a kind of compromise candidate that all these other people sort of tried and failed to be.
Does it show, I'll posit this to you actually, does it show a victory for the left that Elizabeth Warren is the compromise candidate? I mean, because there's a sort of negative way of looking at it, which is sort of like, you know, Bernie got outflanked by someone who is much less anti-establishment than him, someone who's much less willing to take on the vested interest in the United States. But the fact that she's a compromise candidate, that's pretty, they've done all right, right?
I think if Warren had been the candidate in 2016, that would have felt like a massive victory for the left. I mean, I would have been over the moon if she'd have been the candidate in 2016. So yes, I think definitely. But I mean, you know, we've just talked a bit earlier about the Brexit Trump thing, how you think, you know, these sort of, you can't, the things that happen in the US are not necessarily analogous to here, but it does kind of remind me of Ed Miliband becoming leader, in the sense that, like, when Gordon Brown stepped down, there was a sense that there needed to be some sort of compromise with the left. But the left also recognized that there needed to be a candidate that was electable. And so you ended up with Ed Miliband, who was like a kind of, neither left nor right were happy with him because he was either too left wing for some or too right wing for others. And I think, like, she sort of reminds me, Warren reminds me of Ed Miliband in that respect, in the sense that it's like a candidate that neither the sort of socialist left or the centre are happy with, but both will accept for the other one, and both are kind of resentful about because they feel like the candidate has been imposed on them by the other faction. And I think, like, she's also reminiscent of Ed Miliband's leadership in the sense that, like, she wants to introduce progressive policies through the traditional structures of Washington, which I think have shown themselves to be, you know, through the kind of tinkerings of people like Mitch McConnell, have shown themselves to be insufficient for a truly, like, transformative politics. And I think that will be difficult for her. I think if she wins the candidacy, that's, like, great for the left. And I think, thank God it won't be Biden, who I think would be absolutely destroyed by Trump. I think she has a shot. I'm also very partisan on this, and I don't think that she has as good a shot as Bernie at winning the states that she needs to win. And I think, you know, her support is very college-educated, sort of urban support. And I just don't, I think those are not the people who are needed to win for the next election. She needs to present something that will actually make Democratic voters get off their sofas and go to a polling station and vote. And that was what Hillary Clinton failed to do.
Let's go to a clip. So obviously you've said that the debate, well, I mean, Biden's still not out of the race, but I mean, he does look like a fucking idiot every time he speaks on television. So I can't really see him getting the nomination. So it does seem to be like an ideological battle between Warren and Bernie. Bernie obviously now has to try a little bit harder to distinguish himself from the rest of the race. It was easy to say how he was different to Hillary Clinton. Now he's got to make a slightly more nuanced argument about why people should choose him over Elizabeth Warren. He was asked that question, I think, earlier in the week. So we're going to go to that clip now.
So let me ask you, you and Elizabeth Warren have pretty close to identical positions on the big issues. What do you say to those who say that they would pick her because she's 8 years younger than you, she didn't just come through this, you know, didn't just have a heart attack, and look, in the positions, you're pretty much the same.
Well, look, every American is going to make his or her own choice about the candidate that they want, and Elizabeth Warren has been a friend of mine for some 25 years. And I think she is a very, very good senator. But there are differences between Elizabeth and myself. Elizabeth, I think, as you know, has said that she is a capitalist through her bones. I'm not. I am, I believe, the only candidate who's going to say to the ruling class of this country, the corporate elite, enough, enough with your greed and with your corruption. We need real change in this country.
What did you think about that answer? Do you think he's pitched it correctly? He's saying, you know, what's different about me? Elizabeth Warren is a capitalist to her bones. I'm not. So I saw, I think, Bhaskar, who's your publisher, saying on Twitter that this is theoretically quite a good answer. But to be honest, it's a little bit abstract. I don't think there are that many voters in the United States who say, well, I want to vote for someone who's not a capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of abstract, right? So he has to explain, this is what Bhaskar's saying, he has to explain why it's only Bernie Sanders who can give you proper Medicare and who can give you proper, I don't know, a wage increase. Is housing a big issue there? I don't know.
I interviewed Joshua Green for my book, who is Steve Bannon's biographer.
Oh, wow.
And he said that Americans, I think he was quoting from another article, or he was either talking about his own reporting, but he said that Americans have gone from being angry at Wall Street to being angry at the government to being angry at elites in general. And I think that's something that Steve Bannon understood and felt, actually, and so was able to sort of project that. And I think that he sort of helped Trump over the line with that. So I think you're right. I would agree with you that it's not necessarily true to say that American voters are like, I want someone who isn't a capitalist. That doesn't seem plausible to me, but they might want someone who's like, I'm going to take on the elites, you know, because a lot of bad shit has gone down in America in the last 10 years and no one has really been held to account for it. So I can, you know, I think that's plausible.
I mean, Warren also does a version of small P populism, right? How much does she talk about taking on elites?
I mean, I think she definitely rhetorically embraces that language, but I think she does it a bit less. And I also think that in practice, she does it a bit less. I've actually got a Twitter thread of hers here that I think is pretty illustrative of the differences between her and Sanders. And you know, for a lot of people, you know, who don't agree with what I think is basically the Jacobin pro-Bernie consensus around this, they look at Sanders' program and then they look at Warren's program and they see that there's a lot of overlap. And I think for a lot of people, the discussion kind of stops there. They think that, I mean, I don't want to put words in people's mouth, but it's my sense that a lot of people think that the distinction between someone who says I'm a capitalist and someone who says I'm a socialist when they have some policy overlap is basically a semantic one, particularly for the reasons you said, right? How many voters think idiomatically in those terms? But I do think that Sanders and Warren have very different conceptions of power and they have very different political strategies, and that comes out in the versions of populism that both of them embrace. So Elizabeth Warren has a piece of legislation, a plan, I should say, called the Accountable Capitalism Act, and it's got lots of good stuff in it. Requires workers to elect 40% of the board, requires boards and executives to sell stocks, requires 75% of execs and shareholders' approval for political expenditures. So there's a lot of good stuff in there.
And the 40% one's quite big. I don't think the Labour Party have even put a number on that high.
Yeah, and I think Bernie's just put out a proposal where it's a little bit higher. But
I love this arms race. It's like, we'll give them 40%. I'll give them 50%.
Right,
You've got to be careful though with the workers on boards, because I don't know about in the US where union density is very low. Mm-hmm. But in this country, like, workers on boards can sometimes be used by companies to sort of elbow out the union. Mm. And so I think that's one thing I prefer to with Sanders over Warren, is that he has been using his support base to gather support for, like, yeah. And he also wants to repeal the, I can't remember what the legislation is called, I want to say Taft legislation, but I might be wrong about that. I can't remember what it's called. But basically, it's like the American anti-union legislation that doesn't allow things like solidarity strikes. Mm. So for me, that is where he's more socialist. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay. Well, I mean, they're both pitching plans to make it easier to join a union and things like that. But you know, Bernie is actually using his list to direct supporters to picket lines and things like that. Elizabeth Warren, I don't think, has talked as much about the strike wave that's been happening in the United States. So that's another distinction. But I just want to talk a bit about here about this Twitter thread that Warren did about accountable capitalism, because it starts off pretty good. She says, year after year, corporate profits soar for executives and shareholders, but workers' wages barely budge. I'm reintroducing my Accountable Capitalism Act to empower workers and help fix this fundamental problem with our economy. So it's not exactly Eugene Debs, but it's pretty good stuff. Now, a few more tweets down this thread. She says, 181 CEOs signed a biz roundtable non-binding pledge to account for workers and consumers in their decisions. I'm urging companies, she lists them off, you know, to embrace these reforms. And she says, for most of America's history, when our companies did better, our workers did better, and America built a thriving middle class, the Accountable Capitalism Act will help realign our skewed market incentives so companies and workers can once do again well together. So this is a lot closer to a kind of language of liberal corporatism, and one that's aiming for, you know, a kind of generously a kind of cross-class consensus. Whereas, you know, Sanders, if he was pitching, I mean, in many respects, he's pitching these same proposals, often a little more radical. But when he talks about them, he says things like, if there's going to be a class war in this country, it's time the working class started winning it. And again, a lot of commentators will look at this and they think that this is a real, this is a semantic distinction. And functionally, if they're running on similar agendas, there's no difference. And I disagree pretty strongly with that. I mean, the other thing we might talk about, and I think you alluded to it, Michael, is or maybe it was you, Ellie, the basis of support that both of them have at the moment are so different. Elizabeth Warren, I think, wins in every poll with people who make over $100,000 a year. You know, Bernie Sanders, I think it's in the single digits, the number of people who make that much who've donated to his campaign. And the top three employers, by my last count, of people donating to his campaign were, I think, Amazon, Walmart, and Starbucks. Mm-hmm. So these are people who are serving coffee. They're working behind counters. This is the working class. And I think that a transformative policy agenda has a much better chance of succeeding if it's being carried out with, you know, the agency of those people, rather than as part of a something that is, you know, heavily based in the professional managerial class, which I think really needs to be, that's a section of the Democratic base that really needs to be antagonized if any of this stuff is ever going to have a chance of getting through Congress.
Is there a chance that the polls are misleading us? So if you think about the fact that Elizabeth Warren's, I mean, we know this, that Elizabeth Warren's support base is more educated, more middle class, more, I suppose they're both urban, but different areas. There was that great map which showed that where each of them were getting their donations from, and Bernie Sanders was getting the most donations in nearly every part of America apart from a particular part of New York, which was Warren, and a particular part of Washington, which was Buttigieg, and then I think Klobuchar from whatever her state was, Minnesota. So the question was, if Bernie Sanders' more working class support base means that there might be an electoral shock or an electoral surprise, in the same way that, I suppose, we were talking about Brexit earlier, one reason why there was a big shock when Brexit won is because they were they're the type of people who are less likely to appear in opinion polls, but might turn out on the day. So could we see an upset and Bernie actually wins this one?
I mean, I'd like to think so. I mean, I do think that there are, you know, despite his poll numbers not having moved too much, and despite Warren undeniably, I think, surging ahead of both him and Biden, I mean, he has received more individual donations. I mean, he's breaking records. And as you alluded to, there's that map that just showed he's strong all over the country. He's getting money from everywhere. And I think his strategy is premised on pretty heavily on bringing people in to vote who've been disengaged with the political process. I mean, voter turnout in the United States is terrible. And when you look at the I wrote an essay a few weeks ago about non-voters. And, you know, non-voters don't really fit the kind of caricature of just apathetic people who were switched off. I mean, they do tilt much lower income. And when you poll them on why they don't vote, they do say it's because I'm not represented. There's nothing for me to vote for. And I think Sanders' strategy understands that and is very actively engaged in trying to bring lower income people and non-voters into the process. And when pollsters do these analyses, I mean, my understanding is a lot of their calculations are based on past trends, which demographics have turned up before and things like that. And so I think that Sanders may have support that's not being captured in some of these polls. I'd certainly like to think so.
I want to go to another clip. So this is a clip that went completely viral, I think, about a week ago. It was Elizabeth Warren in the, I think it was an LGBTQ town hall. There was actually, unfortunately, we haven't shown that clip, but there was a Joe Biden moment where he says, there's people in the bathhouses having orgies in San Francisco. Or something. I don't know, it's a very strange thing
what?
For this
Biden
old,
said that?
Old white. Do you remember the clip?
I confess, I didn't see this. It must have happened while I was over here.
I should have put it in the script. I'll tweet it after the show. It's very funny. In any case, Elizabeth Warren gave this response, which was where many people in Britain sort of, I saw lots of people from the BBC sort of tweeting it saying, God, she's good. Like, yeah, she can win. And I kind of watched it and I wasn't that sure, but I'm interested to see what you both think about it. So can we get that clip of Elizabeth Warren, please?
Let's say you're on the campaign trail and you're approached. You have been, yes. And a supporter approaches you and says, Senator, I'm old-fashioned, and my faith teaches me that marriage is between one man and one woman. What is your response?
Well, I'm going to assume it's a guy who said that. And I'm going to say, then just marry one woman. I'm cool with that. Assuming you can find one.
I mean, yeah, when I first saw that, I kind of thought it was a flop. I mean, it reminded me of Hillary Clinton's deplorables comment, because it's sort of just like dismissing a vast swathe of the American population, which is a kind of weird thing to do if you're running for president. Also, the fact that the questioner did that kind of accent, I thought was a little bit weird. But I do value success, and the fact that it's been viewed 12 million times on YouTube, mainly by people sharing it, you know, saying this was such a great burn, has made me think maybe it was a good answer. I don't know. What do you think, Ellie?
I'm scared that I'm going to get cancelled for saying this. Someone sent it to me being like, this is great. And my first thought was, she's going to lose the election. And the reason that I thought that is because it's not because I think, obviously, I don't think that any politician anywhere ever should ever express or pander to in any way homophobic opinions. Obviously, that's not what I think. And I also don't think that, you know, the voters that Trump won over Clinton in like Rust Belt states are like just de facto homophobic because they happen to be like blue collar. Like that's also not what I'm saying. I'm just my feeling, my anxiety about it is that it just seems a little bit smarty pants. It just seems a bit kind of like, well, I mean, the fact that I'm saying this is quite astonishing, really. But like, it was just like the kind of inherent like man hating in it. Like, well, I'm going to assume it's a man that's got that shitty opinion. Mm. Like,
to be honest, there are a lot of women who don't support gay marriage.
Yeah, also
they?
Like when I'm like getting drunk with my female friends, like I'm kind
of
I'm
you say all sorts of things about homosexuals.
Yeah, I mean we you promised you wouldn't bring that up. Like, you know, when I'm getting drunk with my female friends, like obviously we will like make a lot of salty comments about men, of course, but it just like I don't know, like I just sort of think if I was like a man living in one of those states and you have this kind of like apparently like wealthy woman sort of just being a little bit smarty pants about it and then like just dropping in that kind of man-hating comment, like
it's also just a Harvard law professor saying if you can get a woman
it's just a bit like who are you appealing to? Like I feel like you're going to appeal to people who will already vote for you, like who I mean, you know, like I'm glad that she gave an I would prefer her to give that answer than to give an answer that was like, well, I respect your homophobic opinion. But I just, it was just the attitude of it that I, like, it reminded me of Hillary Clinton, this idea that, like, this kind of privileged, like, wealthy, kind of upper middle class woman is, like, somehow, I don't know, like, somehow kind of in some way part of the oppressed and that men are the oppressors. And that's what, like, is that what we're going to sell? Is that what, like, they're going to sell and, like, she is going to sell to people who live in former coal countries in America? I mean, yeah, it just made me kind of nervous.
Luke, what did you think about the clip? And also, are you worried that Elizabeth Warren could do a Hillary Clinton campaign Mark II?
I mean, yeah, I have an alternate, but I think equally cynical reading of it, which is comes from a fairly... perhaps dubious source, which is the Washington Free Beacon.
That's kind of source.
Right. The headline here is CNN failed to disclose Warren Town Hall questioner was maxed out donor. So people can look that up. Apparently, allegedly, Morgan Cox, the questioner, has donated a lot to Elizabeth Warren. But I think for me, watching the clip again, I mean, it does seem a little canned. I mean... Perhaps partisanship is clouding my judgment here, but I don't think Warren is. I mean, there are maybe people that want to compare her to Hillary Clinton, and I would distance myself from that. In that, I mean, she's clearly, her politics are clearly, you know, significantly to the left of Hillary Clinton's. Hillary Clinton's politics, I think, were often very hard to nail down. Warren does have particular concerns that she's been very consistent on, at least since she's been in politics and as long as she's been a Democrat. Which isn't that long, it's true. But, I mean, yeah, Sanders has been campaigning for gay rights, was campaigning for gay rights when Warren was still a Republican during the Reagan era. But perhaps that was a little below the belt, but usual caveats about partisanship clouding my judgment. But I mean, I think there is a sense in which a clip like this does have a kind of Hillary Clinton campaign energy to it, to me, or not the clip itself, but the sort of viral quality of it and how it was received. I think that I'm obviously a lot more comfortable with the program that Warren's running on than the one Clinton was running on, which was, I think, pretty openly contemptuous, not just of the socialist left, but of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, I think it was very much a center-right kind of campaign. But I think given how kind of professional and managerial a lot of Warren's most enthusiastic support is, things like this, you know, the good things Warren is running on his side, things like this do have a slight vibe of, you know, the birth of another sort of middle class personality cult, right? Getting excited about someone who, you know, because of their credentials, you know, this is a I do think there are a lot of liberals who think, you know, we get a Harvard lawyer in here with the white papers and the plans, and that's how we can fix things, kind of by fiat and by strength of kind of raw intelligence. And I think that, to say the least, is not a good analysis of how change has worked historically or how it could possibly work in America in 2019.
I think she's like got substance, and that differentiates her from Clinton. There was some data that showed that Clinton spoke more about herself and less about policy than any other candidate for which like those records exist.
Wow. And I think like that's amazing, because it was all about I'm the most qualified woman ever to be United States president, but she didn't have any policies.
Yeah,
whereas Warren's got a plan for everything, which
there's
Hillary
a paper
didn't.
That I will send you the link to if you want to tweet along and put like on the YouTube with the show, but like it's sort of that's what it said. And the other thing that it mentioned as well actually is, as you were saying earlier, that Bernie's donations from small donors is actually like unprecedented in 2016. So I think like, you know, Clinton's whole, like apparently one of the slogans they were thinking of using for Clinton before they settled on I'm with her was hashtag it's her turn.
Yeah.
So Clinton's whole campaign was like, coronate me. That was her message to America. I deserve this. Coronate me. Whereas Warren has substance. You know, she's making arguments. She has policies, she has ideas, and, you know, and I think that gives her a better shot than Biden against Trump, and it certainly gives her a much better shot against Clinton. But, you know, as you say, it is this kind of, like, middle-class personality cult that makes me really anxious, because there are a lot of Americans who feel very excluded by that, who need to vote for this person. Who didn't vote for Clinton, Democratic voters who didn't vote for Clinton, and they need to feel like it's worth them going and voting for this person. And so, yeah, that does worry me. And I'm not sure that Trump has done a significantly disastrous job for those particular Americans, for them to feel that, like, a second term is actually bad enough for them to actually try and go out and... I don't know. I'm as I mentioned earlier, I am just a pessimist, and so I always tend towards the most pessimistic reading of things. So that is something that you should take.
We should have got you another G&T before you came on, although maybe that makes you more pessimistic. I don't know.
How do you respond to alcohol? I am as sober as a judge.
We're going to move from one middle-class personality cult to another and go across the border to Canada and Justin Trudeau. But first of all, you're watching Navarra Media. You're watching Tisky Sour. As you know, this show is only possible because of your kind donations. So if you are already a subscriber, thank you very much. If not, please donate the equivalent of 1 hour's wage a month. We'll be in our new studio, I think, next week, thanks to your brilliant participation in our fundraiser then. But we want to keep getting those subs up so we can have some full-time staff, because that'd be kind of cool. Then we could make, you know, loads more content and it'd all be super professional. Let's go to Canada. Justin Trudeau was elected in 2015 as leader of the Liberal Party after a decade of conservative rule. He won world fame basically for being attractive, fundamentally in a boxer, but also for his brand of modern liberalism. He's a feminist, pro-migrant, and says the right things about the environment. Luke, can you, as our resident Canadian, can you introduce our audience to Justin Trudeau? What was he about, and what have his 4 years in government looked like?
I think the simplest way into understanding the Trudeau phenomenon from abroad is that, you know, in kind of the period spanning, I don't know how far back to go, but, you know, let's say 2014 to 2016, when the U.S. presidential election happened, liberalism everywhere was in crisis, and it was struggling to find a formula that could work against, you know, an increasingly electorally viable right. And Canada was the one place where kind of the old third way liberalism managed to hack, you know, the secret code in order to do this. You know, and Emmanuel Macron a few years later was able to do the same thing. And what it was, Trudeau was a tremendously effective political vehicle, because he had an aura of youthfulness to him. But the Trudeau name in Canada is really associated for, you know, members of Generation X and baby boomers with 1968, which was the original Trudeau mania, when Pierre Trudeau became prime minister, Justin Trudeau's father. And so in many ways, he was actually a vehicle for nostalgia, which is something that you wouldn't know kind of to look at him. And I think what he was able to do was express, you know, he was able to not threaten the elite consensus too much in Canada, or really at all, but was able to express a version of what people really wanted to hear. And so he talked a good game about the environment. He talked a lot about, yeah, the migrant crisis. He embraced a version of kind of Keynesian economics and deficit spending, which was considered very heterodox in Canada and gave his campaign, I think, a misleading populist flair that it perhaps didn't deserve. And so when he was elected, it was very much received in the international press as, you know, Canada's just elected this really good-looking, really left-wing guy. David Frum wrote an article in The Atlantic. I mean, not exactly a reliable source, but just an example of this, an article in The Atlantic where he compared Trudeau to Sanders and Corbyn. And because Canada is such a small country, when the foreign press pays attention to us at all, that actually often becomes the view that people adopt. So Trudeau was very popular for that reason. But his government has, to say the least, not been a very ambitious one. It's favored kind of means-tested social policy. It's been, I think, very technocratically minded. And it has not pursued any kind of big agenda of you know, redistribution of wealth and power or anything like that.
And I was reading your article earlier in Current Affairs, I think from a couple of years ago, an overview, which listed some of the promises he'd broken. So basically, I think in 2015, he promised to implement fully and without qualification the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which had given First Nations in Canada the right to veto natural resource developments of Indigenous people who were getting pipelines, you know, proposed to be built through their lands. This UN declaration says they should be able to veto it. We are back. I hope we're back for a third time. What we're going to do at this point is basically a kind of self-contained show about the Canadian elections. We caught you off mid-flow in part one. Part two, I think you never got a chance to answer the question. And now we're in part three. So we're going to start again talking about... Are you sure we're live? Because it's not live on my laptop. Oh, no, we are. Brilliant. Excellent. That was just a delay.
Once more with feeling.
This one with feeling. Okay. Can you explain to me, Justin Trudeau, who he is, his 4 years in government, help our audience understand Canada's Liberal darling?
Mm-hmm. Well, I could probably do it better now that I've had a practice attempt anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is
good. Second time lucky. Well, third time lucky, I suppose.
Yeah. I think most simply, and I don't think I got this into my first answer, the best way of understanding Justin Trudeau is that he is just a product of a really, of a social media driven news cycle where your ability to go viral, you know, is a major political currency. So, in 2015, especially if you saw Trudeau's stories, it was always about his socks or he dressed up in a, you know, he dressed up as Han Solo for Halloween or something like that. But
they were his more vanilla outfits.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll get onto that later.
Yeah.
The worm has turned.
I think more specifically, you know, Trudeau was the only liberal of that kind who in what was a very difficult period for liberals around the world. He was able to hack the formula for how you keep, you know, the politics of the 1990s, how you keep third way liberalism going in a world where it's under assault from both left and right. You know, and he was able to do that basically by, I think, channeling a version of the elite consensus in Canada while also seeding ground rhetorically, at least to what people wanted. So, you know, there are lots of anxious people, working class, middle class people who do want a government that acts on climate change, that is interested in the redistribution of wealth, you know, who think inequality's gone too far, who care about the rights of Indigenous peoples, you know, who basically support a kind of social democratic policy agenda. And Trudeau was able to, you know, embrace that pretty well, at least rhetorically. I mean, I think a lot of people who voted Liberal thought that they were voting for a left of center government that was going to do those things. And after his election, that's very much how this was received. In the international press especially, you know, David Frum wrote this article in The Atlantic, Canada Lurches to the Left, and he compared Trudeau to Sanders and Corbyn, which of course is absurd. But because Canada is such a small country, there's always a feedback loop with the international press. The international press, especially the American press covering Canada, is always an event unto itself.
It's like someone's noticed us.
Exactly. Right. Like the American perception in particular, but more widely, the international perception of Trudeau came to influence how he was perceived in Canada as well, which just amplified his, I think, false bona fides as a transformative and progressive figure. I mean, basically, he's led a pretty technocratic, technocratically minded, not particularly ambitious government that I think you can see the contradictions in rhetorically embracing all these causes I mentioned while pursuing a kind of a market friendly center right agenda that doesn't antagonize too many people with wealth or power. Climate change is a really good example. The Trudeau position is, well, we're going to build the pipelines, we're actually going to be very zealous advocates for them, but we're doing so in order to generate the revenues necessary to do a green transition or whatever. So that's an example of what the Trudeau project has been in practice, and why I think it's so utterly unconvincing.
We should go back to that climate one. I want to just first of all read out some of the promises he broke. And if you watched one of the previous streams, you might have seen this already. I'm not sure. I don't know when it cut out. But in any case, in 2015, he wasn't just the hot boxer liberal guy. He also had some serious promises in his manifesto. So he promised to implement fully and without qualification the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It would have given First Nations in Canada the right to veto natural resource development. So exactly those kind of pipelines you're talking about. Not only should that have been rejected on the grounds of climate change, but also when Trudeau was in power, Indigenous communities should have been able to veto those pipelines. He ignored that once he was in power. In opposition, they opposed arms sales to Saudi Arabia. In government, they have implemented a $15 billion arms deal with the Saudis. And he said he would increase taxes on the 1%. Did that happen?
So that's an interesting story unto itself. So the answer is sort of yes and no. So they did create a new tax bracket on, I think, incomes. It's either over $200,000 or over $300,000 a year. But they also did something that they called a middle class tax cut, which the highest gate, which was a cut for the tax bracket, I guess, between $89,000 and $200,000.
Oh, wow.
And so the net result was actually less income for, like, less revenue generated through income tax. So it was a perfect kind of political sleight of hand, because they were able to cut taxes in a way that the majority of the gains went to the top 10% of earners, but raised them very slightly for the top, I guess, 1% of earners, and the net result being that there's actually less revenue collected through income tax, and so it's hardly activist government coming back, but that is how it was received.
And from what I can tell, I mean, you might be able to tell me otherwise, but the only thing that it seemed like he's actually followed through on his sort of nice liberal words is on refugee resettlement. So last year in 2018, Canada resettled more refugees than any other country. Mm-hmm. Only 28,000. It's not a huge amount, but I mean, comparatively, obviously, it's impressive for a country with that population to have resettled the absolute largest number in the world. So it seems like it's not all talk, at least on that specific issue.
Yeah,
does he deserve credit there?
I think the government deserves some credit on that. I mean, I think that within Canada, that kind of position is a lot closer to what the political consensus already is, because multiculturalism is really a constitutive part of the Canadian identity and is, in fact, state policy. Like, we have state multiculturalism as public policy in Canada.
And that's because of the Quebec issue. So you've got... Oh, and I suppose First Nations people.
I think it's bigger than that.
The United States is also a country of immigrants, but they don't have a particularly generous refugee settlement policy.
Right. So if you grow up going to Canadian public school, you learn that the United States is a melting pot where people are encouraged to assimilate, and that Canada is a cultural mosaic. And while that is a little reductive, there is some truth to it. In Canada, people are encouraged to preserve their identities is the notion, and there is something to that. I think the government does deserve some credit on that, but again, there's a lot they've done rhetorically that's masked places they're coming up short. So Trudeau had this famous tweet, this super viral tweet, where I think it was on the day of Trump's Muslim ban, where he tweeted something to the effect of, all are well, though, to those fleeing persecution and danger and violence, all are welcome in Canada. But of course, there was no actual change in Canada's border policy over that. Canadian authorities are still cooperating with American border services. So asylum seekers coming in, trying to come into Canada through the United States are not, there's something called the safe third party third country agreement, which is restricting the flow of asylum seekers from the United States. So this is one of those things where, again, I mean, I suppose it could be argued that there's a value in just rhetorically challenging Donald Trump. But I think from my point of view, Canada could be doing a lot more on this issue. And I think Trudeau's the plaudits he's won internationally is actually kind of obscuring some of the places where his government could have actually done a lot more.
Mm. Let's talk about the campaign. So the reason we're talking about Trudeau is not just because you're in the country, but also, I mean, it's a happy coincidence, really. There is a general election on Monday. Trudeau is going to be facing re-election, or is up for re-election. What's going on in that election? So I suppose we're going to talk about a particular controversy in a moment, but first of all, I want you to set the scene. So Trudeau is up against a conservative opponent. Mm-hmm. They're who he replaced, mm-hmm. and now you've got an insurgent Social Democratic Party, mm-hmm. which is the, what's their name? The National...
The New Democratic Party.
New Democratic Party, shit. I should have remembered that. I have got it written down. You need a more famous Social Democratic Party, I'm afraid. So set the scene. What's at stake in Monday's election?
So there was a piece on Navarro's website that, I guess, it can't be more than a few days old, but I think it conveyed very well what the received wisdom about the campaign was until just a few days ago. The campaign initially looked like it was going to be a very sleepy affair, a kind of a status quo election in which the conservatives were going to very boringly posture to try to replace the liberals by a narrow margin. We're probably going to fail in that attempt. But also the liberal campaign, there was not as much excitement as in 2015. They don't have a particularly bold or ambitious campaign they're doing. They're really doing a classic, you know, defending their record after one term. And there's also this major scandal referred to kind of colloquially as the SNC-Lavalin scandal, which involves the Trudeau government having the Trudeau himself, his office, having pressured his then attorney general to basically let this Montreal construction giant off the hook. And then they were kind of caught out on it and they had to change their story multiple times. It was quite embarrassing. So these were the kinds of things that were kind of swirling around. And it was looking like a very boring election, also one that was going to be potentially very difficult for the NDP, which is Canada's Social Democratic, historically third party, mostly third party at the national level. But in the last 7 days, to be generous about it, there does seem to be a real surge in the polls for the NDP. And it's unclear how far this is going to go. There was a poll this morning from Ipsos, which is a polling company in Canada. Conservatives at 32%. That's down 2 from the last poll. Liberals at 30, down 5. NDP 20, up 5. And then the three smaller parties, Greens at 8, Bloc Québécois at 7, and the People's Party, which is kind of a hard right party, sort of split off from the Conservative Party at 2%. I mean, I think if the momentum, this is a bit of an ambitious reading, but I think if the momentum continues, and I think there's every sign that it will, the NDP could actually go higher than 20%. And we could be looking at some really unpredictable results at that point. Before we started recording, I looked at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, its election poll tracker, and the seat projections are all over the place. So it's really
unclear.
You've got
a first past the post system like we have, right?
It's a first past the post system, and the voting is kind of heavily, it's very different depending on which region of the country you're in. And so no one knows what's going to happen. At this point, it seems unlikely there's going to be a majority government. So we could be back to another election, you know, in the next few months or something like that. But it's grown very unpredictable and potentially very interesting I guess it wasn't a short answer, but it's the simple answer.
And the spanner in the works in the election. So you said it was looking like it was going to be a kind of dull election. Now you've got an insurgent mm-hmm. Social Democratic Party mm-hmm. and Trudeau is dipping in the polls. One reason for that, and the reason that, you know, everyone in England will know about, is because a bunch of, not one, but I think three photos of Justin Trudeau in blackface emerged online day after day after day. I think we can get those up. Apologies, because the link I've got is to The Sun, which we should in theory boycott. But
Sun just, and the Free Beacon in one episode.
They just had the pictures in high resolution. So can we get those pictures up?
Sorry, people of Liverpool.
So first of all, there was... Well, we haven't given them any money, have we? And we're not going to show the adverts.
If anything, we've stolen...
In fact, we're stealing their intellectual property. So in 2001, there is an image of him when he was a teacher in a private school wearing a turban and blackface. Then you've got one from the 1990s. He's in They Are Up. Fabulous. My WhatsApp just came up. In the 1990s, he is in blackface and an Afro wig singing Deo at his school. And then there's another one from the 1990s. This is at another party. This one, he hasn't just painted his face. He's also painted his arms and his tongue. So this sort of undermined his status as a liberal, open hero, as it were. And I mean, what's more, he doesn't know how many times he's done this. He seems to have a real penchant, in fact, or seems to have had a real penchant for dressing up in blackface. Before discussing, you know, these images and what it says about the Canadian election, we're going to go straight to the clip of his apology, if that's possible. Can we go to that now?
Darkening your face, regardless of the context or the circumstances, is always unacceptable because of the racist history of blackface. I should have understood that then, and I never should have done it. But I recognize that it is something absolutely unacceptable to do. I appreciate calling it makeup, but it was blackface. And that is just not right. It is something that people who live with the kind of discrimination that far too many people do because of the color of their skin or their history or their origins or their language or their religion face on a regular basis. And I didn't see that from the layers of privilege that I have. And for that, I am deeply sorry, and I apologize.
You told us last night on the plane that you were, that of all of the different instances that you recalled, have you since been made aware or remembered of other instances? And if so, how many?
I am wary of being definitive about this because the recent pictures that came out, I had not remembered. And I think the question is, how can you not remember that? The fact is, I didn't understand how hurtful this is to people who live with discrimination every single day. This has been a personally a moment where I've had to reflect on the fact that wanting to do good and wanting to do better simply isn't good enough, and you need to take responsibility for mistakes that hurt people who thought I was an ally, who hopefully many of them still consider me an ally, even though this was a terrible mistake.
Ellie, I don't know how many, you know, kind of male feminist woke guys you've had to tolerate, but how did you take that apology? How do you think that scored? To be honest, it was quite well rehearsed, wasn't it? He did all that, you know, I didn't realize it because I've got all this privilege. There was even a moment where he sort of corrected one of the questioners who'd said that you wore makeup, and he said, I appreciate you calling it makeup, but you know, it was blackface. So he's sort of like schooling the questioners to show that he's now really understood what was wrong about it. What do you think?
I feel like, yeah, I can't speak to what it feels like as a person of color to see something like that, of course, but from like a feminism point of view, yeah, I feel like every woman who is a feminist and is assertive about that has had the experience of like a man trying to be like a kind of woke male feminist, and yet usually they do say stuff like that, you know, like that is the kind of stuff that they say. They talk in like these sort of vaulting terms about their privilege, but then they'll take you to a house party and leave you and go and get off with somebody else, you know, like, that is, by the way, that didn't happen to me, but I was thinking of a specific man who did actually go out with a friend of mine and gave her all this spiel about gender studies and whatever, and then like literally did that to her.
And that's Trudeau, but he does it also in blackface.
Yeah, and you know what I was thinking like, you know, I love 30 Rock. I think it is genuinely hilarious TV program. I know that, like,
I've never seen it actually.
Well, we can debate whether like it's hilarious after. I personally think it's hilarious, but like, but it is quite dated in its politics in lots of ways. And one of the characters does wear blackface in 30 Rock, and I watch that now and I sort of cringe at that, and I think this is really not aged well. But then on the other hand, I feel like if blackface was actually acceptable in my lifetime, and that actually it was just a case that things have moved on since Justin Trudeau dressed up like that, I feel like surely I would have gone worn blackface at some point. I've been to Halloween parties, I've been to costume parties, but I never have. And I think, looking back on it, I think I never have, because we grew up with programs like Mind Your Language. Well, they were in the 70s, but we grew up, our generation grew up with the understanding that programs like Mind Your Language were embarrassing and dated and racist.
So that was one of those 70s sitcoms where they're all a bit racist about the neighbors.
Yeah, I feel reluctant to say who was in it, because just in case I accidentally malign a sort of national treasure. But like, it was a program about, I think it's about kind of Asian neighbours. And the actors in it spoke in sort of cartoonish Asian accents and wore blackface, basically. And I think, you know, people of a certain age grew up understanding that that was dated and racist. And so this idea that it was... That blackface has been acceptable until relatively recently, I'm not sure that I buy that.
Well, it is weird. I mean, obviously,
I feel like I would have considered wearing it at some point if it was completely fine. But I never have, because I feel like I've always understood that is racist. You know, we've also grown up with the idea of minstrels. We've known that minstrels are racist. So I don't think the idea that blackface doesn't have, like, it's always had racist connotations, and I think for a very, very long time.
We can now, let's look at Matt Lucas from 2011 on the BBC. So that's from 8 years ago. So it is. I guess
that's what I'm thinking of. You know, things like that.
Obviously, it's completely racist, but at the same time, and obviously, I'm in no place to excuse Justin Trudeau, but it's a bit like that Elizabeth Warren one, you know, where she's like speaking to the guy who's talking about gay marriage as if, you know, like, oh, I'm sure you can't get a girlfriend because you're against gay marriage. That was only legalized in 2013. So before 2013, to not think gay people should get married wasn't considered. I think it always was homophobic, really, to say that gay people shouldn't get married, just as it always was racist to wear blackface. But I think sometimes as a society, we do pretend that our recent history was actually much further in the past than it in fact was.
Yeah, perhaps the thing to say is, like, there is racism that we collectively, and homophobia, and indeed sexism that we collectively tolerate, and then there's racism, homophobia, and sexism that we deem beyond the pale. And at one point, certain things move over to the other side. But it doesn't mean that, like, I think we've always known that those things are racist, but we've always just kind of turned a blind eye to them. And then, like, eventually things change enough for us to say, well, now we can't turn a blind eye to that. But it doesn't mean that when they were being done in 2011, like in that clip, that it wasn't racist. It's just that,
oh, you know, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. It was racist in 2011.
It's always been racist, but it was societally, it wasn't exceptional, I suppose, is the point, right?
Yeah. And I suppose that's the point I'm trying to make when I say, like, you know, I've never dressed up in blackface, and neither have lots of people. And it's not just coincidence. I'm making myself sound like I'm really virtuous, but what I mean is that there has been an understanding for a long time that it's racist, but it was considered a kind of a racism that people weren't actually bothered about.
There's some interesting comments. So Jay says, Ali G, postmodern Islamophobic racism. I think lots of people look back at that thinking that was pretty racist.
Yeah, and he's like an Oxford... Cambridge.
Posh Cambridge white boy pretending to be a poor... He was pretending to be a poor white guy, pretending to be black, wasn't he?
Yeah, Ali G was white, but he sort of...
A Starry Space Fox says, I mean, it's not society, it's white people. Fair enough.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Numerlane says, blackface was definitely unacceptable and racist back when Justin Trudeau did it. I think we're all agreeing with that. It's whether it was exceptional or not. The voice of... In any case, I mean, he was painting his face during anti-racist struggles. That's what Alex Quack says.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I think the reason that it's been so particularly damaging to Justin Trudeau is because he built this extremely cloying brand off a particular kind of, you know, social justice politics. And this is kind of the ultimate is kind of the ultimate, it's the ultimate proof that that really was just an act. That really was just kind of performative. And you know, he's done a bunch of other things which I think are low key. He's been racist in more subtle ways before, and they just kind of haven't been noticed. So in 2015, during the election, there was some kind of television program about where they had the leaders on to discuss. They had the three male leaders on to talk about women's issues, and there was a question about violence against women, and his answer basically made it sound like he was blaming rap music. He was saying that's the cause. He said there's a lot of misogyny in certain kinds of music or something like that. In this boxing match with it, which I think was alluded to earlier, he himself has referred to that. It was a boxing match with an indigenous conservative senator, and he's referred to that. I think it was in his Rolling Stone interview, when he was on the cover of Rolling Stone a couple of years ago. And he basically says, we thought this sent the right message. We thought the implication being that, me, a white settler, white patrician settler beating up this indigenous man, is good branding. And people have always kind of ignored this when it comes from him, because his brand has always been kind of too big to fail. People are too emotionally and politically invested in it. And I think it's extraordinary, even in that answer that he gave that you just played, where he's apologizing for doing blackface multiple times and saying that he can't even put a figure on it, he still manages to quite adeptly make the whole thing about himself. As you pointed out, he corrects the reporter. Yeah. And this is, if Trudeau has any real political skill, it's that he can turn even something like this, he can kind of absorb it back into his brand. Although I do think this has potentially damaged his image irreparably, and I think that is probably one of the causes of the NDP surge that's going on right now. Although I think there are others, and we should probably talk about those too.
Yeah, let's talk about the NDP. So they've got a new leader, Hugmeet Singh.
Jugmeet Singh.
I read on his Twitter, he said it's pronounced Hugmeet, but I mean, you've obviously heard it said on the television more than me, so Jugmeet.
But then football commentators do call Jose Mourinho Jose Mourinho.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to take your version. Even though that is how he phonetically described it in his Twitter bio. In any case, can you explain to us the leader of the New Democratic Party and why you think he is surging in the polls? We're also going to show a clip in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so I think that, Canada's hard to, people often ask me, like, so, is the NDP like Bernie Sanders, or is it like the Labour Party? And, the answer is kind of no, in that I don't think in Canada we don't have this kind of same populist energy that exists in some other countries. We don't really have, but we do have I think pretty ideologically committed form of social democracy, and his leadership, I think, has really moved the party in that direction. It's moved it to the left, and there is a pretty solid social democratic agenda that's being campaigned on. He's also talked about the need to decriminalize drugs and end the drug war, which is a pretty bold thing to do. And I think he's been very well received. He had a very low visibility before the campaign. He's had much higher visibility. There's been a lot of racism directed at him, and he's dealt with it extraordinarily well. So there was an incident a few weeks ago when he was campaigning in a marketplace in Montreal, and a man came up to him and said, you should take off your turban so that you look Canadian. So there've been a lot of incidents like that.
What was his response?
He just sort of politely, he really did hold his own, and he just kind of politely pushed back. He said, something to the effect of in Canada, being Canadian means you can wear whatever you want. There was I think the one and perhaps only televised debate last week. I think most of the press gallery agreed that it was kind of his night. He did very well. If you ask the average pundit in Canada why there's an NDP surge, I think it would kind of stop there. My own reading is that The NDP platform is also very popular, and the Liberal victory in 2015, as cynical as I am personally about it, and as disingenuous as I found a lot of their rhetoric, the fact was it was effective because people thought they were voting for something like a kind of social democratic agenda. And so now, after 4 years, people realizing you're not going to get that under Justin Trudeau, there's a possibility that we could get it with the NDP, and I think people are actually pretty excited by that possibility. So we'll have to see how far the surge goes.
That's what, when I asked for a clip from you to sort of demonstrate how he presents himself and, you know, why he's been effective and why he's inspired people, you showed me this one of him talking about getting water to communities in the First Nations. I've actually just checked up why my pronunciation mistake came about. His Twitter bio is jug like hug meat, and I thought the hug was referring to the whole of the JUG, but it was only referring to the UG. Mm-hmm. So this is Jagmeet Singh answering a question about a plan to fund pipelines for clean water to First Nations in Canada. Can we get that clip up now?
Are you just writing a blank check for all problems for all Indigenous communities across the country once you get into office?
So if Toronto had a drinking water problem, if Montreal had a drinking water problem, would you be asking the same question?
It's a lot of money, is what I'm saying. And people will look at it and go, how much money are we going to spend on all this? And how are you going to find that money?
That's a genuine question. Would you be asking this question if Vancouver did not have clean drinking water? Would you be asking this question if Edmonton did not have clean drinking water? No, you wouldn't. And that's what I'm saying. Why is it that we ask the question about whether or not Indigenous people should have clean drinking water? We got to take a minute and think, why is that even a question? Yes, they deserve clean drinking water. Yes, we can make it happen. It's a matter of priority, and I'm going to do it.
A politician shifting the debate by their saying it's going to cost, how much was it, 1.8 billion? How much was they saying it's going to cost X number of billion to give, or for the state to provide, clean drinking water to various Indigenous communities in northern Canada? And the question was, are we going to be able to afford this? How much is it really going to cost? And the answer is, look, would you even ask that question if it was about Toronto, if it was about Montreal? And it's, you know, it completely floored the questioner because you wouldn't. Mm-hmm. There would not be a question if in London, for example, a whole borough didn't, well, it depend, I suppose we can talk about racism and economic inequality in London. It might depend on what borough you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about Westminster or Islington, then there isn't going to be a price limit on getting that area water. And I suppose, is he shifting the debate in Canada? Another question, how live is this issue of the rights of Indigenous people and First Nation Canadians in a general election?
I mean, it's a very significant issue, I think, partly because there's a lot of just visible urgency around it, but also because in 2015, the Liberals campaigned pretty hard as they were going to get serious on Indigenous rights, and the Conservative government that preceded them was certainly not serious on them. So I think it has some added resonance because a lot of Indigenous people voted Liberal in 2015, and they didn't get the kind of government they thought they were gonna get. And so I think that answer was really just channeling that. There's a lot of there's a lot of smugness in Canada. I've written about this before. The Canadian identity around kind of multiculturalism and diversity and things like that. That has much to commend it. But one of the things it often functions to do is it convinces people that as long as a politician's talking about Indigenous rights, for example, that means everything's fine. Canada's a multicultural country. These problems aren't very serious. You know, the elites are looking into it. Everything's going to be fine. And that's just not the case. I mean, there are people in Canada that do not have clean drinking water. And as Jagmeet Singh says in that answer, if that was Montreal or Toronto, that just wouldn't be happening.
And so, I mean, we'll go to questions in a moment. But first of all, let's talk about, you know, potential outcomes. So it seems like if there is a surge for the NDP, then could it be the case, is a possible or even likely outcome, that you have Trudeau re-elected as the leader of the party with the most seats, but in a coalition with the NDP? And would that be a real progressive moment for Canada?
It's possible. So Singh has said that he's open to a coalition government, and I don't think Trudeau has ruled it out yet. My reading of the NDP posturing that way was actually that it was designed to force the liberals to reject the idea. I'm not sure if that's the case or not. That is a possible outcome. I mean, it's very difficult to know how the seats are going to break down. I think we could end up having an election very soon, another election. It seems hard to imagine any party having a majority of seats. Things have become really volatile and unpredictable at this point. And with, I mean, I guess it's Tuesday, right? So there's less than a week to go. But if the NDP momentum continues and there's a point before the end of the campaign that the polls, that the Liberals and the NDP has leapfrogged the Liberals and they're in second place, the Liberals will then start to lose a lot more votes because there are a lot of people in Canada that will basically vote for whatever the non-conservative option is, which is one of the things that's always served the Liberals very well. And that might still happen in this election. But if the NDP momentum continues, the outcome could be really extraordinary, and then we'll just have to see what happens. I'm somewhat wary of making predictions given how volatile the whole thing is.
Would it be a good idea? Someone's asked this in the comments as well. Would it be a good idea to go into coalition with Trudeau if you're a member of the NDP?
I think if the NDP were to do that, there would have to be some really clear. The coalition would have to have. I mean, there'd be first a question of is it actually a coalition government? Are there NDP cabinet ministers? I'd have to think more about that. My instinct is to say that might not be advisable, but it could also be some kind of formal accord where the NDP says, we'll give you the confidence of the House for X amount of time, provided you implement this agenda along with us, which we'll vote for. And I think the terms of that would have to be pretty strict. The Liberals should not be allowed to stay in power. Unless they're gonna, reverse on a lot of their, they need to raise rich people's taxes. They need to change the electoral system. They need to cancel pipelines. They need to build affordable housing. They need to extend Medicare to include pharmaceutical drugs, dental care, mental health care. There's a lot they need to do, and I think the price of the NDP's support should certainly be very, very high.
Let's very quickly go to questions, and we're going to do these quick fire because I think actually the sound and vision, if the comments are correct, has somewhat gone out of sync. Oh, no. And as the stream has already gone down three times this evening, let's not try our luck. But if you've got any questions, now is your chance because we are going to end this stream in about 5 minutes, I reckon. So if you've got any desperate ones, put them in now. Whilst you're doing that, we are about to move studio. We will have better internet in that new studio, which means that streams will go down less, hopefully never. I still don't understand why sometimes at the end of streams our mouths start moving at a different pace to the audio. I think that's probably because we need an upgrade of our software, and the way we upgrade our software is a bit more money. So please go to support.navarramedia.com. And people are saying the sync is fine. It was just the problem with someone else's laptop. So, I mean, still give us some money. Sync is perfect. That's great. In any case, I'm very pleased about that. Give us some questions. People are asking whether other people are still in the old chat. When will Michael and US Nation get a TV studio? Michael and Oz Nation.
That's my podcast.
Oh,
incredible.
Sick. you're in a different continent.
I am, yeah.
So I don't know how that would work. Yeah, plug your podcast while I'm collecting questions.
So yeah, Michael and Us, well, that's a podcast I do with a fellow called Will Sloan, who's a longtime friend and colleague of mine.
I thought the Michael was me. That's why I was confused.
Yeah, it makes sense. I wasn't sure at first what the question was.
Yeah.
But so Will and I met in student journalism, and maybe 11 or 12 years ago when we met, we for some reason had a lot of conversations about the documentary filmmaker Michael Moore, who I guess in the early 2000s was kind of formative for both of us. So we started this.
I love Michael
Moore. We started this kind of vanity project, kind of ironically watch all of Michael Moore's filmography again and look at it through the lens of current events. And it turned out there was a lot of material to mine because a lot of his films, I mean, some of them hold up, some of them suffer from a lot of limitations that liberalism, I think, continues to suffer from. And so then that led us to going through kind of season two was going through all of the sort of bargain basement conservative documentaries that were anti-Michael Moore because they were really scared of him in 2003, 2004.
You would call him a liberal?
I would say it's complicated. But
I feel like a liberal would never have made capitalism a love story.
His films have I mean the audience for his films is pretty diverse. I think often his politics are better than is sometimes conveyed in his films. I've quite warmed to him in the last few years again because I think he's been on the right side of a lot of issues and he's been very perceptive about some things. But of course, we eventually exhausted the Michael Moore thing, and so now it's sort of just a general politics current affairs show where often the centerpiece is a piece of cultural paraphernalia, sometimes from the earlier mid 2000s. So I'm delighted that a Michael and Us fan is
More than one. A also asks, has Michael and Us considered doing any Adam Curtis docs?
Yes, we have.
And Joseph O says, this is a question, but then also it has a big up. Have green issues been a prominent issue in the election after the pipeline scandal? Also, big up Michael and Us Nation. That's from Joseph O.
Wow. Yes, green issues have been.
Do you want to expand? I suppose I said it was quickfire. That was quickfire. Yeah. That's good. But I mean, they're not surging in the polls, are they?
Oh, well, the Green Party is a whole other story. And I mean, something I could have mentioned when I was introducing the election is that the Green Party was actually looked like they're on course to do pretty well, and even in certain scenarios maybe overtake the NDP. And the Green Party in Canada is a little bit strange. It all kinds of people run for it. It's sort of an ideologically catch-all party. I mean, my understanding of the UK Green Party is that it's generally been pretty firmly left of center. I don't know if that sounds accurate to the two of you, but Canada's Green Party is not really like that. It's very much a sort of personality vehicle around the leader, Elizabeth May. Mm.
Ours is a bit of a personality vehicle,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
Caroline Lucas.
But that kind of happened by accident, just because they only had one MP, so there was sort of no choice.
Right.
I don't blame her, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's great as well. I think she's made some missteps over Brexit recently, but generally she's been brilliant.
Yeah. But so, yeah, Canada's Green Party is a little weird, and they usually pull better during elections than they do on election day, and all indications, I think, are that's going to happen again.
Max Shanley has a question, and he's being very persistent with it.
Hi, Max.
And it's probably good, but it's one of those questions where I don't understand it, so I'm just going to have to read it blind.
Okay, I'm scared now.
Is it about the Labour Party rule book? Because that would be a very Max question to ask.
I don't think you're going to know what it means either.
No, okay.
I think it's Canada specific. So Max Shanley asks, can Luke talk about the waffle?
Oh,
and
I'd
how
love
its
to.
Defeat stunted the development of the NDP?
It's a really interesting question. So the waffle was the kind of left faction that was involved in the NDP in the early 70s. And at one point, it commanded something like a third of support, possibly more, at an NDP convention. The waffle was a sort of new left movement, I suppose in some ways analogous to, the Bennites, although I suppose they came later. They were kind of peaking in the 1980s. But they were, all kinds of things came together. Much more radical kind of socialist economic agenda, and also a lot of kind of anti-war sentiment and things like that. The waffle, though, was also heavily premised on a kind of economic nationalism, which I confess, and this will disappoint Max, but I don't think I've done enough critical reading on the waffle. I'm very sympathetic to it. I don't think I've done enough critical reading on the waffle's nationalism. There are people who will argue that nationalism was a limitation rather than a strength. Nationalism in Canada has somewhat of a different connotation because it was nationalism that was resisting, American capitalism. So it was a left nationalism. Certainly there was a lot of populist energy in the waffle, and when that was gone, I do think the NDP suffered to reclaim it somewhat. I'd love to talk to Max in more detail off mic about the waffle sometime.
Mm. Ellie, any opinions on the waffle now you know what it is? I haven't formed any in that period
no,
of time.
No, I
either.
Was just thinking I like waffles.
Yeah, waffles in general.
Waffles are delicious, and in the US they have chicken and waffles, and it's
fucked up.
No, it's incredible. For breakfast. I had it for breakfast when I was there once.
Let's end it there. I want to get another beer. I want to open the window. I want to do a little troubleshooting, work out what's going on with our technology. But thank you as ever for watching Tisky Sour. Thank you, Luke Savage. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks.
Ellie Mae O'Hagan, it is always a pleasure.
Why didn't you invite me on this more often, Mike?
We'll do. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Great.
I'll book you in.
Excellent.
We're actually going to, speaking of that, we are going to be upping the regularity of these podcasts as these tumultuous times speed up. I'm pretty sure we're going to do a podcast probably on Friday, depending on what has been agreed at this EU summit, or if sometime towards the end of the week. Follow us on Twitter. The next feed we do will last the whole time. It'll be in sync. It'll be absolutely beautiful. But yeah, thank you for watching. Good night. Thank you both. You've been Cheers. Watching Tisky Sour.